Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
This is the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber and member of the Ethics Experts community, welcome. Hope you're having an amazing day. See what happens when you join the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So that alone is enough to subscribe and join this community of people who are changing the world. I am here with my good friend, Lisa Bond Holland. Lisa, how's it going?
It's going well. Today's a beautiful sunny day. It's not too cold here in Philadelphia, so it's going well.
Very nice. Yeah, nice to have a little ray of sunshine in January in Philadelphia, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'll take it.
We connected last year, kind of before the holidays, and we kind of had a really fun conversation nerding out on ESG and the opportunity that this is can potentially have in not just our own kind of careers for our departments, for our own, you know, companies and their pursuit of their broad mission, but really the entire economy, if more people can kind of pick this up. Since we've connected last, what have you seen kind of changing on the ESG landscape? And maybe you can say that from the perspective of what your role is and how you've been sort of riding these waves of risk and ESG and, vision management, so to speak, in your own corner of the world.
Yeah, sure. So as an ESG practitioner, as a director of ESG for my organization, things change on a daily basis. And since we last talked, I would venture to say that what I'm seeing is more of the integration of ESG into the financial world and into the business sector. Mm-hmm. It's now becoming more of a formalized process. I think originally when ESG came about and really came into the limelight, it was a thought that it was a fly-by-night topic that really would not grow any teeth. But that is farther from the truth. I mean, as we continue to move on with ESG, we continue to see how our regulators, our legislators are looking at ESG topics and bringing them to life. So that's really what we've been seeing since you and I last talked, is really just the integration of ESG and the proliferation of the initiative in the finance world and in the business world.
So, I mean, shareholders are ramping up these requirements. What do you think is, you know, what do you think's the cart and what is the horse here? Is it the sort of authentic drive from an organizational perspective to live out this sort of stakeholder approach to capitalism? Or is that really being pulled forward by sort of more socially conscious or environmentally conscious investors who are starting to demand that of the vehicles that they're putting their dollars behind?
You know, I think it's really a mixture of the two, but I would venture to say it's the latter, right? So BlackRock, Larry Fink, is really a driving force with the paradigm shift to more looking at stakeholders and capitalism and deciding how we move forward. As you know, the Business Roundtable made a change, if you will, in the way they operate and suggest businesses operate. I think that was almost 2 years ago. And we're seeing that paradigm shift come to life through the policies and proposals that almost all investors are making of public companies around climate change, around human capital management, diversity and inclusion, cybersecurity, board diversity. Mm-hmm. So those are, I think, the priorities for investors right now. And I think that has to do with where we are. But also has to do with, I think, a shift in who investors are, right? So there's a paradigm shift there with regard to, we have, especially when our non-institutional investors, we have, you know, a younger set of individuals who are investing in companies and they care about different things. So while they care about the share price, they also care about how this company is moving in the world, right? How they affect change on the world.
Right.
And so there is that shift that we're seeing.
Yeah. And, you know, at some level, that's always been around to some degree, right? Like there were investment funds back in the 70s who just wouldn't invest in tobacco companies, for example, because they didn't like how they made their money, even though those were highly profitable organizations. It's been cool to see that fractal out into sort of more facets on the shape, not just sort of the sin industries, but kind of, which is kind of an avoidance perspective, right? Like I want to avoid... Right. these types of companies or these types of industries, it's really expanded to like a new principle-based approach to say, well, regardless of the industry, I want a company that's going to espouse these kinds of values in an authentic way. To your point, from a board diversity perspective, or from an inclusion perspective, from the resource human resource management, or from, you know, the way that they move in the environment and so forth. So that sort of, it's almost like it's like a next generation of that ethos that was like in its adolescence back in the day, you know?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And those practices still happen today. There's still a lot of avoidance for certain companies, for example, tobacco companies, gun companies. So there's right. still, you know, areas, coal companies now because of climate, still areas and industries that are experiencing that with shareholders. But, you know, shareholders and investors are looking at companies saying, you know, what, as you mentioned, not to, to re-articulate what you mentioned, but what can you do? What are you doing? And how are you doing it, right? It's not a matter now of just saying that you're doing it. Investors are now asking companies and issuers to prove that they're doing it, right? So you can put something on your website and say, we are the most sustainable company, prove it, provide me the data. And so I think that's another shift that we're seeing where there's a lot more that's required. So if you say you have your mission and your vision and you say you are a very diverse company, you believe in diversity and inclusion, then you need to prove it. And shareholders are really holding your feet to the fire. I think Nike recently in 2021 had that experience where they had several shareholder proposals. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a request by an activist shareholder where they were asking them to please provide evidence of the effectiveness of your diversity inclusion. So don't show us that you believe in diversity inclusion, show us the mm-hmm. effectiveness. So essentially they were saying, show us the data, show us that you're moving the numbers right. with regard to maybe your representation and turnover. Those are just two examples, but I know the proposal asked for the board to disclose a annual report that was evidence of the effectiveness of their diversity and inclusion. Now, the proposal did not pass, but that just gives an indication or shows what the expectation is for organizations now.
I mean, that ain't gonna be the first one of those that we see. You know what I'm saying? I mean, right. it's a canary right. in the coal mine. It's a leading indicator of like where this whole thing is moving. And exactly. It's such an, you know, I'm a very opportunistic person. I see a lot of opportunity in kind of everything, but like there's such an opportunity mm-hmm. for organizations of any size to start bringing some of these things that are probably happening in the organization to the surface and putting them on a slide deck or putting them somewhere, putting them on a web page, because, you know, well, I'm going to make a claim or I'm going to make a statement and I'd like you to like, you know, push back on it if you think it's off base.
Sure.
But gently, please be gentle.
Okay. I'll be gentle.
Okay. But I think our organizations are full of people that are trying to make the world a better workplace. They have a heart for other people. They're empathetic. They want to push change forward. And there's a lot of little activities happening in most all of our organizations, whether it's, you know, somebody who's in HR picking the HR training and they're really trying to find the one that has the best discrimination, you know, discrimination and harassment modules that really sort of articulate what's at the core of, you know, driving more diversity or driving more inclusion or creating the type of culture that matters. And there's people, you know, in the plant who really care about, hey, we're not dumping, you know, we're not dumping chemicals in the ground because we're really caring about the environment and stuff like that. There's little pockets of ESG happening and bubbling up throughout our entire organization. And to some degree, the first step that an organization that's looking at this, you know, almost monolithic, amorphous thing that ESG is, that's a buzzword that's flowing through the Wall Street Journal and coming out from investors' mouths and so forth, is just to kind of pull some of those data points together, to your point, to help show that, hey, we're not a perfect company, but look, we're doing this and we're doing this and we're doing this.
Right.
And you can get out ahead a little bit of those, you know, soon to be coming, you know, activist investor, quote unquote, proposals or, you know, requests, because there's already that stuff happening. Like we're not starting from scratch, yeah. is my point.
Exactly. Exactly. We're not starting from scratch, but you know, one of the things I think may be happening, and this is just, you know, I guess the world, according to Lisa, right, as an ESG practitioner. So as you gather that information that you're already doing and providing and just disclosing that to, as per the request of the shareholders, disclosing that information is categorized under human capital management or climate, you're also going to come up with some things that you're doing that you may not be doing well. Right.
Okay.
And so investors are asking you to air your dirty laundry, if you will. So let's choose diversity and inclusion because that's the easiest one, right? So if we're talking about, you know, what does your diversity and inclusion look in your executive ranks, I would venture to say that the majority of organizations, public companies out there, numbers may not look as well as good as they would like, right? So mm-hmm. how do you disclose that information? Do you disclose that information and then also tell the story about your mitigating efforts? Do you set targets and show a trend over time of how you're improving? So I think that, again, that is, I think that is that's the rub, if you will, with regard to ESG, because you're expected to disclose this data and this information. And you, like you said, it's low hanging fruit. It's things that you may be doing, but you may not be where you intend to be. But you have the initiatives in place. So how do you tactfully provide that information to the outside world so that they are gathering the data and get the true story of what the organization is doing? So go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, let's circle in on that. So, I mean, you said that like, that's the rub. So, you know, explain to me, like I'm five, the rub is what? That I'm embarrassed to step on the scale, so to speak, and show everybody what I weigh? Or is it, and in that, you know what, you have to kind of spin it, or that's what the desire is, or like, how do we navigate through that? And how do we kind of wipe the slate clean and say, listen, we are where we're at. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. If you're ever going to lose weight, you have to step on the scale to see like where you're at, right? I mean, that's almost the first step or something.
But it's like with anything, so before ESG and before I was corporate secretary, sprinkled in there was enterprise risk management. And so you have to understand what your organization's tolerance is to disclosing some of the risk.
Okay.
Right. And okay. Making sure that you've through collecting this information that you want to disclose and showing how you're a good corporate citizen, you have to make sure that anyone that sees it is digesting it correctly. And understanding what the full picture is, right? And so the numbers, the data may not look as good to the public because they're just looking at data, but you know internally that you have mitigating steps in place, you have an initiative in place, but it's gonna take time. It's a journey. DE&I is a journey.
100%.
Right? Exactly. And so you just have to be committed and get the organization ripe to share that data and the trends around that data so that your story is told over time. And so that's the rub. And that is the challenge.
So let's talk about that some more, because I think that's a great point. You're just getting a snapshot. At some level, because there's no regulation and it hasn't been boiled down in terms of like what we need to disclose, it's kind of a blank canvas to some degree. So I'm speaking in broad brushstrokes, but correct me if I'm not understanding what you're saying right, but there's almost an opportunity for us to tell the story around the data points that are going to be those sort of objective supports for whatever the topic at hand is. So again, circling in on diversity and inclusion, if the numbers aren't where we want them to be, but there's been some improvement from 5 years ago or something, and we have a plan on where we want to go in the future that is going to be somewhat credible because, hey, we have a goal. It's like a SMART goal, right? Specific and measurable, attainable, and you know all those things.
Right.
Then perhaps that current snapshot from today can have some context around it and have some dimensionality to it. And it'll be easier to palate from an investor who doesn't have the context and doesn't know maybe necessarily where you came from and stuff like that. Is that kind of the challenge that you're talking about?
Yes, I think that's the challenge, right? Because it's atypical in how we disclose information, right? Generally, organizations disclose the pretty picture of how you're doing well, unless you're forced to disclose information by a regulator or by legislation. But voluntarily disclosing information, naturally any organization would lean towards painting a pretty picture. But the pressure is on to provide data for which an organization may not have the internal structure in place. And so the challenge is to create it. And now is the time while this information is only voluntary. We're only expected to disclose voluntarily. As you mentioned with regard to Nike, we have some leading indicators that this is the information that the outside world is going to want. So if you don't have the mitigating steps in place, if you don't have the controls around your data, now is the time to develop it before you're forced to put that picture out there and you're not ready.
Great point. That's actually a phenomenal point. If if the whole system is broken, so to speak, or maybe right. that's dramatic. Let's say that there's room for improvement broadly. Well, that broad picture that I'm just painting is an amalgamation of all these individual companies that in sum total are in line with this sort of brokenness or this room for improvement. So there's, I think there's a risk that ESG falls kind of flat from a credibility perspective. If, as you dig into each one of those sort of composite organizations, everyone's presenting this like really rosy picture of like, well, we ain't broken. Well,
right.
If the sum total is broken, then obviously there has to be broken pieces in all of these little
pieces.
Yeah, exactly. So
exactly.
So I want to get into how you got into this position. And I mean, you obviously get this game, you get the big picture of it, not only from your own organizational perspective, but from sort of the broad opportunity that this presents across our economy as organizations can, you know, become better or do well by doing good or whatever that saying is. But what pieces of resistance have you met or have you seen among other practitioners who are fighting the good fight, for lack of a better term, in their own, you know, their own organizations with respect to sort of this authentic display of these data points that might not paint the rosiest picture?
Yeah, I wish I had a good story to tell. I mean, ESG is I won't say it's new, but the growth of ESG has occurred, I would say, over the past 3 years. And so an ESG practitioner is a new phenomenon. So I am a nurse by trade. I started my career out as a nurse and worked healthcare and then moved over to the utility business. So a little bit non-traditional career. And here I am as an ESG practitioner, learning about the world of capitalism. I think a lot of people that are ESG practitioners come from the non-traditional sector. Some may come from the environment sustainability side. And so I don't know that we've encountered any difficulty with developing the story because it's so new and it's all voluntary. And so here's a classic example. So when I joined my company 3 years ago, you know, there was no formal ESG process. No one had really heard of ESG. And so we developed the process from responding to ESG raters and rankers. And then, you know, just continually reading the tea leaves over the 3 years of what was happening in the world and in the financial world, we developed our program. And pretty early on involved enterprise risk management. Again, I have an enterprise risk management in my background as well, to help us determine what were the material risks and what were the material issues for our organization. Now, when you start building ESG program, you do a materiality assessment. So you ask all your major stakeholders, what are some of the major risks out there to help prioritize your ESG risk? And so there's been a paradigm shift there. I keep using that word, but there have been a lot of paradigm shifts with ESG. And so I don't know that there's been any difficulty because developing the program is the build is still happening.
Yeah.
And so it's a bit premature to determine what works and what works well, what doesn't work well, because it's all so new.
I have
Did that address your question?
Yeah, it did. I think, you know, it's really early in the game. And I think some of the things, you know, I guess some of the things I was asking about were kind of in anticipation. I mean, if we don't have a lot of stories of these now, in a year, we obviously will, as more and more folks put it out there, and then more and more of these reports come out there, and more smart people like me and you and others, investors and so forth, start to read them and say, well, this is kind of a snow job. This is like, this is a bunch of hogwash. Like, you know, I mean, that potential is there, right?
So we'll there's just a term for
see
it,
where
actually.
It goes. Oh, hit me.
Yeah. There's a term. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. There's a term for
fine.
It. It's called greenwashing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a concern with, again, as if people or companies are out there telling their story, you have to prove what you're saying at this point, right? You have to show the data, you have to show the trends. And now there is starting to be, at the very preliminary stages, some litigation around greenwashing, especially at the state level. Attorney generals are using consumer laws to bring forward misstatements in ESG reporting. So there is starting to be some litigation around misstatements and not doing what you say you're doing. And then we're seeing the proposals from the shareholder activists as well.
Yeah, it's there's a wave swelling for sure. It'll be interesting to see like where it crashes and on which shores and so forth. Let's dive into a little bit more about your story. The way that you kind of high level discussed, you know, your ascension to this role, it seems so organic. Did it feel as organic as you sort of, you know, so elegantly put it? First one of the year here, folks. Was it just kind of a natural ascension, and did you sort of naturally fall into it? Was there some internal persuasion from you or others that said, hey, this is something that we need to get out ahead of? Because I mean, there are a lot of your competitors, I'd imagine, who don't have ESG practitioners like you do, a defined right. position, and they're probably a little bit behind the eight ball. So how did you guys kind of get out ahead of it to the extent that you feel like you are?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of a divine intervention and a little bit of a perfect storm. So this actually was one of the first projects, responding to a Raider and Ranker was one of the first projects that I took on when I joined SJI. And when I joined my organization, I was the assistant corporate secretary. So my role still resides in the legal department, but I was working with the board of directors. Doing my work as assistant corporate secretary while working on ESG off the side of my desk. And as ESG proliferated, our program proliferated along with it. So the growth of our program was a little bit non-traditional. Again, not the way people would develop or someone would develop a program today. I was lucky enough to come up with a team of individuals within our organization that got it. And once I explained what was the need was around ESG, we were able to develop our first ESG report fairly quickly. That's the perfect storm, right? I was lucky enough to have the right individuals that got it. And many of them are still on our my team today. When I say my team, I have a team that I don't own. They come from other areas of the business, but we have a task force and I've worked very closely with them. So that part was the perfect storm, which allowed us to leverage our existing data and develop our program. And it just grew from there. And the opportunity was there. My organization was ripe and they got it. They understood the need and where this thing looked like it was going. It all just fell into place. It really did. And then probably about a year and a half ago, I took on the role of ESG director full time.
I have to pause you because I kind of don't believe you. I know you. You're a very persuasive person. And like they got it because you explained it in a way. And I'm not saying that like it's all you, but I'd like to dive into that because at some point you guys didn't have the program. At some point, like you said, it was on the side of your desk. And fast forward, now you have it. And now you're the director of it. And you have a team that you don't own, which are always kind of the best teams, by the way. Because it's united around a mission and it's united around a common purpose versus some, power by position or something. But either way, like when they got it, how did they get it? How was it explained to them? How were you able to push that forward? And again, I'm not trying to give you all the credit unless you want to take it. But I'm sure it didn't just fall in your lap. There was some change management for it to get to where you're at. So was the board pulling it forward? Was it just a bunch of light bulb moments going on kind of together? When they got it, what was that kind of process like?
So what was that process like? That's funny. So you're making me dust off the cobwebs. I have to think back to how this all started. Honestly, at the time when I joined the organization, we had an interim corporate secretary, and I think Anne's role was she was really the VP of Treasury, right? So she understood the financial world. So ESG came up through the finance, and so she was getting signals from the street about ESG. Mm-hmm. And so it made sense to her as we, developed the ESG program. And our organization is small. So I was able to get this information in front of the CEO and members of the senior team fairly quickly to start educating And once you educate your senior team, you're able to start building a program kind of on the side, you know, responding to the raters and the rankers, determining what information we need to disclose. And then next thing we knew, shareholders were asking for data. So that's the part where it kind of happened organically. But, you know, getting it in front of your senior team and getting that buy-in, that's number one. That's crucial. Because now with the program being the way it is, it has to be integrated into your organizational strategy. So, you know, like I said, it was like a perfect storm. And again, it does help that our organization is small. Our senior team is within reach, you know, they're not in the ivory tower. So it makes it a little bit easier for an important initiative. If you're able to provide the business imperative and tell the story, then you can, you know, help sell, if you will.
Yeah, that definitely helps. That proximity is such a factor for sure. But you have such like a unique background. You're an attorney, you're a nurse, you have risk management. Now you're kind of at the forefront of this ESG thing. And it's a really interesting career that you've had. What is it about this role? I mean, I can read people pretty well and I can tell when somebody is like really alive, and you seem like you're really in your, you know, you've hit your stride, or you're like, you're in the right thing. You're in the right vehicle to be putting like your unique gifts to work. What is it about this position that really like resonates deeply with your soul? And how is it different than other things that you, you know, have done in the past?
Yeah. So one thing, you know, looking at my career, my personality and my leadership style, one thing that I realize about myself is, you know, no matter the fact that I'm not in healthcare, I still feel like I need to be of service. This role within the corporate world, within a public company, allows me to feel like I'm being of service. I'm helping my organization show their true colors to the investment world, to our legislators, our stakeholders, through ESG. And that is the lens that I look through every day. So how can I improve this program so that I can help tell our story? I enjoy working at SJI. I enjoy working at the company. It's very collegial, and I do get a sense that everyone there is committed to the work that they're doing. So that also makes it very easy to move forward with this initiative. In addition, just looking at the overall initiative, it touches on every aspect of my career. I mean, I think I've done a little bit. Yeah. I've got what I call the poor man's MBA, because I've worked in, you know, when I was working in healthcare, I worked in various areas. I did a stint in HR, ERM. So I'm able to leverage everything that I've experienced in the past in this role. And I think that's why I was able to hit my stride, because I was able to bring all of that knowledge into this role.
Isn't that cool? Like,
it is
sometimes your life takes these weird paths and you do this thing and like, it doesn't make sense until you're like, you know, and then you look back and you're like, oh, all these bricks built this wall, you know?
Yeah. But I have to say, I definitely miss nursing. Hats off to all the nurses out there.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely miss patients and being at the bedside. Yeah. I definitely miss it.
So what was it that prompted you? I mean, you could have just been a nurse. What prompted you to say, you know what, I want to become an attorney as well? What was that catalyst?
Okay, so you're gonna move us away from ESG, but happy to share my story. So, you know, probably about year five of being a nurse, I just felt like I wanted to do something different. I felt nurses, and as you can see today, I felt nurses really didn't have a voice.
Mm.
We are crucial to the healthcare system. Crucial to being at the bedside. I hope no one ever has, you know, someone in their family that's seriously ill. I used to be a critical care nurse, but out of that 12-hour shift, I was at the bedside 12 hours. Mm. And not to, you know, do a disservice to a lot of the physicians, but, you know, once you're through surgery, I worked in surgical intensive care, the doctor's there 20 minutes to an hour, you're lucky. And so I felt nurses didn't have a voice. And I was looking at the next step for me, and I thought, well, I'll go to law school and I'll be an advocate for nurses. But then life happened and that didn't happen. But I still have a good amount of years left in my career, and it could be, but that was my overall desire, was to be an advocate for nurses, because we are the lifeline.
Yeah.
And I say we, because I still have my license. We are definitely the lifeline of the health system, and unfortunately, we're, you know, this that is being illustrated and broadcast to the world right now through this pandemic.
Yeah, that's that is so well put. Where does this, you know, this sort of advocate heart and this sort of empathetic, caring heart, where does that come from? Have you just always been wired that way?
I've always been wired that way. Yeah, I think I have a personality. Yeah, I have a little bit of my mom and a lot of my dad. I see it in my own kids, especially my two sons. But my daughter also just recently told me that she's interested in being a nurse, and I'm all for it. I'm all for it. I think I'm just built that way, to have, you know, more of a caring nature. And because of that, moving away from healthcare and more into the business world, I have more of a servant leadership style when it comes to my leadership style. You know, even though, you know, I try and put my team first and be out in the trenches with them. So, you know, I'm not the dictator type. And so it that part still, you know, of my personality still comes up in the corporate world.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the happiest times of my life are when I'm helping somebody. And, you know, not when you get something that's like temporal or like monetary based, but when you create an opportunity for somebody or you help somebody out or you know, I mean, that's really what life is about. And I think for many years, and this is going to be like a shorthand explanation, but for many years, we've been so in the shareholder focus instead of the stakeholder focus, where it's all kind of boiled down to dollars and cents. And it's all boiled down to, well, what's the bottom line and human, you know, the human resources of the organization are really just, you know, labor units. I mean, that's the era that we're coming out of. And I think that ESG is really a great vehicle and a great catalyst for folks like you who have that, who have this heart, who are in these sort of guardian roles, whether it's risk, whether it's, I don't know, I mean, name it, legal, if it's HR, who have gotten into these roles because there's something about trying to make a difference in the world that drew them to these positions. Well, now this is a way for us to like catalyze our power and be a point of leverage to actually drive forward this change in a meaningful way across our entire economy, not just in the, you know, bedside interaction that we're having, just to use a metaphor.
Right. Yeah, no, agreed. And I guess the other aspect, I guess of my personality or the other aspect of my career that I think I'm enjoying about ESG and this particular opportunity is the build. So sitting in at the table within a lot of board meetings over many, many years, you learn a lot. And that was something that I never had the opportunity to do, was to build a program that would have a positive impact. I always, you know, entered into a program when it was already implemented. So I'm really enjoying the build of this program and watching it grow, and seeing where it's going. I had no idea that I would enjoy it as much as I do, but I really do. So if you're a person that likes to build something, this is definitely an opportunity, a role for someone who's interested in doing that.
Yeah, that's a great point. So let's say somebody's in a different type of an organization who they're not surrounded by people who are just going to get it from a couple of conversations, or they don't have this sort of backup from somebody in the finance department that's like, hey, we really need to get out ahead of this thing. What little steps would you be taking, or what pieces of actionable advice would you pass out to another practitioner who's out here, who's trying to drive that change forward and is like trying to kind of be that sprout bursting through the surface of the soil? What are some nutrients we can give them to, you know, move faster or actually drive some change?
Yeah, you definitely have to be strategic and relational. And the reason why I say that is because this program would not be what it is if I didn't have the relationships that I have within the organization. And so if you're just starting out, the key thing, and I've said this before on other webinars, is to start. That's the first thing. Because this thing is coming, this train is moving, and everybody's got to get on the train. So start. But I would definitely have conversations with the leaders that you have access to begin discussions about what ESG and what ESG could look like within your organization. Because if you don't have the buy-in from leadership, the program will grow, but it won't grow in the direction that you need it to grow in. You'll have a harder time integrating it within your organization, within your strategy, without leadership buy-in. So have those conversations, make sure you have a good business case. and they have an understanding of what ESG is and why it's an imperative for your organization. Bring in those individuals that can help tell the story, help tell the business case, your investor relations person, your person that's helping you with sustainability and climate for your organization, however that may be. A little bit easier for global organizations. You have to, because you know, the UK is ahead of us when it comes to ESG. So they already have regulation around it. But if you're a small cap or a mid cap, it's a little bit different, right? Because most people are going to be like me. They're going to be doing this off the side of their desk. This may not be their main role. Luckily, now there are a lot of consultants out there that can help. So just be strategic and do your due diligence around consultants. If you need to, you can bring in a consultant to help you start the program and do your materiality assessment so you can get an understanding of what ESG priorities are most important for your company.
So I want to circle in on the consultants thing and not throwing stones at consultants. Well, not all the consultants. I'm not going to throw stones at all of them. What are we looking out for with a consultant who's coming in for this? What would be a tip off that they don't know what they're talking about? Because let me back up. I'll stop there. What do you think? I mean, we all know how these consultants are sometimes. They come, oh, hey, I'm an expert on this. Like, you know, everybody throws that expert term around.
Right.
And then you have somebody coming in who's really just read a white paper from Deloitte or something about this, who might not actually know what they're talking about. So what kind of things would you be pushing on to see, you know, is this person really going to help me drive my thing forward? Or are they just going to shake a couple nickels out of my pocket to pay their fees?
Yeah. So I think what's important is, you know, you have to have some idea of what your ESG priority, and it will depend on, I think, a little bit on the industry, right? So we are a utility company. So of course, climate is a priority for us, you know, as well as human capital management, cybersecurity, and safety. Those are not the only ones, but I would venture to say that those are our top priorities. Okay. So you have to know that, right? And so when you're going out to work with a consultant, do they have the requisite expertise, subject matter expertise on their team that can help you build what you need to build for your organization? And so we're going through that a little bit with trying to consider who we would like to help us with assurance around our data. Right. And so there's an argument in the ESG world. Should you use some of the top accounting firms, or should you go out to maybe some climate consultants that have the requisite expertise? Well, we know that the accounting firms are starting to build their ESG team. So hopefully they'll get the scientific knowledge they need to help you. But those are the things that you need to evaluate when you're looking at who is going to be looking at this data, and do they have the requisite knowledge to provide us to opine on this?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. You know, you have to find the shoes that actually fit your feet, you know, if you're going to go on a long journey.
Exactly.
So yeah, this has been a lot of fun. My last couple of questions for you are this: if you could get into a time machine and go find a young Lisa who's just maybe about to get into nursing school, or maybe just coming out of high school, and give her some advice that you wish you learned earlier, what would that be?
Advice that I wish I learned earlier. So you threw a curveball in there.
I'm throwing curveballs. I'm throwing floater pitches at you today. Yeah.
So if it, especially if it was a young nurse, the world is yours. Nursing is a very good profession. It's very much like the law. You go into nursing and thinking that you will only be doing nursing, and that you know you're a clinician. But what nursing does is it prepares you for other opportunities, right? So I learned my leadership style by advocating for my patients and taking charge and making sure my patient was okay. So you're learning other skills, other skill sets that are transferable into other professions. And so that is one thing that I wish young nurses knew, that nursing prepares you for anything else that you want to do, whether it's stay in nursing, be a leader, continue your education around nursing, or take a leap into something else. I had the very unique opportunity of working in a health system where the CEO was a nurse, the CIO was a nurse, the VP of strategy was a nurse. So there were a lot of nurses in non-traditional leadership roles that, you know, illustrated my point that you can really do anything. And right now, the CEO that I work for, she's one of the CEOs of the health system, is now I guess her title is Secretary of Health for New Jersey. And I learned a lot from her. Nurses can do a lot. And that's what I would tell my young self. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a cool thing to learn. I want to ask you, what was it like working in that organization that was really a nurse, you know, it was all nurses up in the leadership roles? How did that organization feel differently than other places you've worked where it's just some MBA running it?
Well, you know, that's a hard question to answer because not only was it, you know, led by a nurse and there were a lot of nurses in integral positions, it was also a faith-based health system. So I would say I worked within that system as a nurse and then transferred after I graduated from law school. So 25 years in a bubble because it was a non-traditional environment because it was faith-based. Wasn't always led by a nurse, but when Judy took on the role, you know, it was an interesting experience. It was empowering for me because again, I saw people who were doing things, sat in my shoes at one point and were doing things that were elevating the organization. But also that is also where I learned about servant leadership because each one of those and all of them at that time were women. So each one of those women showed me how you can be successful with a servant leadership style.
There's so much in that. We can have a whole another episode about that thing, but it's kind of circles back to the diversity and inclusion thing. We have to see other people like us doing things that we don't think are possible to do those things and achieve those things. And it's so powerful to see, oh, wow, this person's like me. I could do that. Oh, wow, this person, wow, I can do that. And then you can start to see how these experiences can build toward that path or build toward that path. It's just such a powerful thing. And I can really nerd out on the nurses thing a lot because I think, you know, you talked about it taught you that servant leadership and, you know, nurses are the lifeblood of our health system, 100%.
Yeah.
And I think the best nurses are, they meet that patient where they're at and that patient's going through something unique and they're going through something that's really difficult for them and they can resonate with them and they can make them feel better on a, you know, emotionally and physically and all those kinds of things. And at the end of the day, we're all just, you know, we're all patients, so to speak, in our particular jobs, right? Like we have our anxieties and our insecurities and all those kinds of things. And that's really the touch points of any leadership and any business and anything that you do to the extent that you're working with people and you're not just staring at a screen coding all day. That is how we communicate. That's how we grow. And that's how we drive influence, you know?
That's right. And where I'm seeing this real time is the push for diversity on boards. You know, I actually read an article where there was someone that was taking issue with NASDAQ's rule for to increase board diversity and said, you know, we can't have people that don't have the requisite experience or skill set on boards. And, you know, I would push back against that and say, you know, I would encourage boards to consider non-traditional individuals for a board seat if they have the requisite knowledge and skill that can help provide the oversight and carry out the fiduciary duties of the board, then why not? So like I said, I was in healthcare my entire career and moved to a utility company and it's not about me, but this is what's happening. And I'm now building an ESG program 100%. For a utility company. So, you know, does that make me a candidate for a board? Maybe. but my point is that, you know, the requisite skill set is transferable and it can be work and be successful.
Well, yeah. And like, I don't know. I mean, when you come out of school as a nurse, you're not ready. Like, look, when you come out of school, you've done accounting, you've learned all the accounting, you've passed the CPA. You're not like that good of an accountant. You learn so much on the job and you apply those principles and you can, you know. Yeah, it's all transferable and it's all building and nobody steps into a job of any meaningfulness and knows how to do everything in it. You have the wherewithal to do it and to figure it out. So sounds like we may need to have a series of additional episodes to talk about some of these things because it's such limiting mentality, you know, to think that somebody can't grow into something. And also a board is, I mean, I have a lot of opinions about this, but a board is a diverse, you know, should be a diverse group of individuals who together can create a synergy of oversight and governance that allows an organization to really pursue its mission in a more efficient way. So it's not just one person on the board. You understand what I'm saying?
Right. Anyways, exactly.
Lisa, a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people reach out to you and learn more about you and connect with you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, Lisa Bond Holland on LinkedIn. I work for South Jersey Industry. So best way to get me is via LinkedIn.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on The Ethics Experts. Until next time.